message for you. You got a message for me. My day will come together and sit down by the fire. 3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Daily double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You're on the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR.
Good morning.
Oh, yeah, with me, Hannah and and Rob.
Thanks for introducing me.
Sorry.
That's okay. You're sleepy this morning.
Sleepy again.
Yeah. And it's bleak. Like, it's so dark early in the morning now.
Oh, my God, your mic's so... Okay. Yes, it is okay. Really. There
it's,
you are.
It's really dark early in the morning now.
It's dark again. Yep. How are you?
I'm good. My energy has been zapped by moving houses.
Oh, yeah, moving is hard.
It was maybe the easiest house move I've ever done.
Yeah.
But somehow it's still just like, it's like, I don't think there's a way to do it where it doesn't zap your energy, hey.
Yeah, I saw you in your car.
Oh, yeah.
With a box in there. I was like, hey.
There's so many boxes in my car. I felt so bad because I asked one of my friends to help me with their van. Like, they have a van, so that we put mm-hmm. all of my big stuff in his van.
The trouble of people with a van, always helping people.
And then, like, yeah, I was basically like, okay, now you drive an hour and then I'll drive an hour
mm-hmm.
in separate cars.
Oh.
And I'll see you when I get there.
Oofed.
Because, like, yeah. It doesn't make sense for me to leave my car here unless you want to, like, drive me from Windhamvale to Brunswick East and then back again.
2 hours, yeah.
You know, that's like 4 hours of driving.
Yeah.
Yeah. For free, you know.
Yeah, my friend has a van and she's always helping people.
Yeah, I think you buy a van, that's the price you pay. But I think he actually enjoys it.
You'd hope so.
Because he went and looked in my backyard. He's like, okay, well, like, what do you have? He's like, okay, we do this and this and this. And
he's mastered it.
Yeah, yeah. So he's clearly like, I mean, literally pack a whole, like, a full van out of my car in 45 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm trying to declutter my room.
Yes.
So that just in case I ever have to move.
Yeah.
It won't be.
That's the thing. Like, I had all of my stuff in a shed. So, like, the weekend before I moved, I was like, maybe I should go through it and see what the state of affairs is. And then I was like, I actually can't be bothered.
Yeah, it does get to a point where you're just throwing bad. Random stuff in random boxes.
Yeah, and it kind of was like that.
Yeah.
So now I'm just like, but
no, just in a
I'm
room.
Paying the price for my own, for my own laziness, I guess.
Yes, I do that every time
as well. Should we talk about what's happening on the show this morning?
Yeah. First up, we're going to be listening to an interview that I had with fire behavior scientist Phil Zylstra. 2 weeks ago, Zylstra was a signatory among other scientists and researchers with GECCO, Goongra Environment Center, calling to stop planned burns in the Snowy River National Park. We chat about the impacts Vic Forest Fire Management Vic Forest Fire Management's prescribed burns have on wet forests and the consequences they will have in the future.
I'm so excited to hear that.
Yeah.
We aired his speech a few weeks ago in the March for March for Forests,
yeah.
Which you can listen to on the 3CR website. I think it's on the Monday Breakfast page.
Yeah, I was really excited to talk to him because when I studied conservation and ecosystems, I read heaps of his papers, so
whoa.
I was trying not to
bit of a fangirl, man.
Yeah, I was trying not to be a fangirl.
So fair.
Yeah.
That's so fair.
Yeah.
Anyway, after that, that's going to go pretty much all the way up until 7:45. So we'll, at around 7:45, we'll be playing a short segment from the People's History of Australia podcast talking about sort of the use of Anzac Day and commemorating Australia, the Anzac's involvement in World War One, and how the state sort of uses that to justify repression. So yeah, really interesting. The segment that we're playing is actually at the end of the podcast, and I thought it was the most sort of relevant bit, but that whole episode is really interesting, talking about like worker strikes and living conditions during that time for working class people on this continent. Mm-hmm. And then following that, at around 8 a.m., we will be speaking with Bo Spirim, who is the host of the Frontier War Stories podcast about the Frontier Wars, because obviously April 25th is a day to commemorate the Frontier Wars. So I'm very excited to speak with them at around 8 o'clock about that. And then do you want to talk to us about your interview, Hannah?
Yeah. I've listened to heaps of the Frontier War story, so I'm excited for that one.
That's going to be really good.
And we're going to end off the show speaking with Libby Jamison. She used to be a programmer here at 3CR. And we're going to be, it was Lesbian Visibility last week, so we're going to be talking about her show that she had.
It was Lesbian Visibility Day yesterday.
Oh, yep.
Is it yesterday? I don't know. I think you're the authoritative source.
We're going to be talking about the show that she started, I think around 96, called Dykes on Mics, and talk about, yeah. And also because it's the 50th anniversary this year.
Of 3CR.
Of 3CR. So yes. It'd be good to talk about some
old... Lesbian Visibility Day is on April 26th every year, but it does, of course, cap out a whole week.
Yeah.
I think it's appropriate to give a whole week.
Yeah.
For lesbian visibility.
Totally.
Anyway, that's what's happening on the show today. Maybe we should get into our headlines, huh?
Yeah, sounds good. Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later,
you're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 27th of April, 2026. A public forum this week is set to examine the growing power of corporations and governments to collect and control personal data as concerns mount over privacy, surveillance, and the militarization of technology. Hosted by the Australian Peace and Security Forum, the webinar asks a central question: who really controls the vast amounts of data generated through everyday life, from shopping habits to online activity? The discussion comes amid increasing scrutiny of companies like Palantir Technologies, which has expanded its presence in Australia, including a reported partnership with Coles. The forum will also explore how data is being used in modern warfare, particularly in the development of remote and autonomous weapon systems, and the lack of public oversight surrounding these technologies. Speakers including Bianca Baggiarini from Deakin University and Dennis Desmond are expected to address the ethical and political implications of data-driven systems, as well as the broader impact on democracy and national sovereignty.
Also in news this week, disability advocates are warning that sweeping changes to the National Disability Insurance Scheme risks thousands of people out of essential supports as the federal government moves to rein in costs. The overhaul would tighten eligibility and shift people off the scheme, raising concerns that disabled people are made to carry the burden of a system under political and financial pressure. NDIS Minister Mark Butler has defended the changes, framing them as necessary to control spending, saying, quote, "The NDIS costs too much and is growing too fast. Unless we take action to make it sustainable, it will simply not be there in the future," end quote. But disability advocates say the language of quote-unquote sustainability is being used to justify cuts with little clarity on what happens to those who lose access. CEO of People with Disability Australia, Nicole Lee, has previously warned reforms must centre disabled people rather than budgets, saying, quote, "People with disability must not be left worse off as a result of the changes to the NDIS," end quote. Campaigners argue the reform risk shifting people into already underfunded systems is deepening inequality and limiting access to the support needed for independent living, raising broader questions about whose needs are prioritised when essential services are framed as economic problems.
And finally, in the news this week, residents of the remote Aboriginal community of Papunya are taking the Northern Territory government to the federal court in a landmark case over unsafe public housing in extreme heat. The case, supported by the Human Rights Law Centre, argues that decades of neglect have left homes without basic protections like insulation, shading, or reliable cooling, despite temperatures regularly exceeding 40 degrees. Papunya resident and applicant Ashley Robertson said families are being forced into unsafe and unsustainable conditions. Ashley said, quote, "Climate change means when it gets hot, it's really hot. When it gets really hot, people have to sleep outside. It's hard on the kids and older peoples," end quote. Community members say the crisis is compounded by overcrowding and high electricity costs, with some families going into debt just to keep homes cool. Local leader Gerard Anderson said the conditions are unlivable. They said, quote, "In the summer when it's hot, it's just impossible to live in these conditions." The NT government hasn't been listening to Aboriginal communities when it comes to housing, end quote. Senior lawyer Jack McLean argues the case could get a national precedent, forcing government to ensure public housing is safe in a warming climate. Jack McLean said the situation reflects a broader failure. They said, quote, "Families live in houses that turn into ovens in the summer months. The Northern Territory government should be taking urgent action to invest in climate-safe housing," end quote. If successful, the case could compel governments across the continent to lift housing standards as communities continue to face the frontline impacts of climate change. These have been the news headlines for Monday, the 27th of April. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR 855 AM.
The Black Lives Matter movement is not going away here or overseas. It gives me hope seeing the numbers of people that turn out to these Invasion Day demonstrations in Melbourne. It gives me the understanding that we will win, folks. We will succeed!
You're listening to Radical Radio on 3CR, 855 on your AM dial, 3CR digital, and podcasting and streaming on 3cr.org.au. Help
3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR on 855 AM. First up, we're going to be bringing you a conversation I had with fire behaviour scientist Phil Zylstra. 2 weeks ago, Zylstra was a signatory among other scientists and researchers with GECCO, Goongroo Environment Centre, calling to stop planned burns in the Snowy River National Park. We chat about the impacts Vic Forest Fire Management prescribed burns have on wet forests and the consequences they will have in the future. Stay tuned. Would you like to start off by telling me a bit about your science background and how you first got involved and interested in fire science?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I came from a background originally working in agriculture and I did a degree in environmental science at Charles Sturt University and started working at national parks just part of the fire management team. I didn't have a huge amount of fire background at the time, just burning pastures for graziers mainly. But it was mainly the 2003 bushfires across the Alps that it burned about 1.5 million hectares at the time. It kind of tipped me into becoming very interested in the subject. And the main reason for that was that I could see a lot of what we were doing just wasn't working. And our understanding of how fire worked seemed to at times be almost opposite to what was happening. And so that really got me started in trying to work out what was really going on. And I went on from there to do a PhD to better study those things.
Yeah, lots of people think that controlled burns benefit ecosystems and prevent future fires. Can you tell me about the effects that planned burns have on wet forest ecosystems?
Yeah, so any kind of fire in any forest is a disturbance that resets a component of the succession. A natural succession, particularly in a wet forest, means that there's a gradual increase in biomass in the forest. The burning ideology has a theory that the more biomass there is, the more dangerous the forest is. But that's not how it works, because of the simple fact that trees grow and get taller. So if you start out soon after a disturbance, you've got plants that are close to the ground because they're regrowing. Anything that's close to the ground is ready to burn because heat rises, so it starts from the ground. So low plants are closer and easier to catch fire. As those plants get taller, they become less likely to catch fire. And when they're not burning, they slow the wind speed underneath them, which actually slows the fire down. So you've got biomass that starts out as fuel close to the ground, but as it gets taller, it turns into overstory shelter, which is plants slow fires down. And then that actually has ongoing effects, because the more biomass you have that's tall and with deep roots, the more competitive that is. And that stops the smaller plants from growing as much. So you end up getting a more open understory. And in a wet forest, you never get a fully open understory because there's enough moisture there to keep plants there. being more mesic plants, they're much more water intensive, I suppose. Greener leaves, very heavy chlorophyll, and it means that they, probably getting too technical there, I suppose, but they're very dense in phosphorus when they're shaded. The reason that's important is that if you ever see a fire on the news, there'll almost always be a picture of a plane dropping pink stuff on the fire.
Mm.
That pink stuff is a phosphorus compound, which changes the combustion reaction so that the fire doesn't burn as well. It doesn't put it out, it just makes it burn slower. That's what happens when you've got phosphorus concentrated in the leaves of plants. They are inherently less flammable. So the longer you allow a forest to mature, a wet forest, the taller the plants are, the less likely they are to ignite, the more they slow the wind speed beneath them, and the more they ensure that any plants growing under them are fire retardant. So it just continues to become increasingly less flammable.
And for young forests or areas that have been logged, can control burns help the impact of future bushfires, or do they increase these impacts?
Yeah, so again, it's reintroducing another disturbance.
Mm.
So straight after any disturbance like that, if you've created bare ground, as you do with a fire, you have a very short period when it's hard to burn. And that's what prescribed burning is entirely for. It's aimed at trying to manage as much country as possible to have that short-term bare period. The problem in the theory of it all, though, is that that short-term period is followed by a much longer-term period of plant regrowing, where it's much more flammable. So you get this kind of trend in flammability of very short-term flammability and some decades of very high flammability for those plants tall enough. So if you reburn a forest that has been logged, yes, you get a very short-term period where you can help slow the bushfire down. But after that, you've reset the clock. You've now got a long period of high flammability.
And what is the difference between a prescribed burn and a cultural burn? What are the differences in the ways that they do that for the ecosystems?
So a prescribed burn comes from American forestry theory. Mm. It was used to reduce the amount of pine needles on the ground underneath pine trees, and that's why we talk about fuel load. It's just the weight of pine needles, and we've just co-opted that language and applied it to Australia. So the idea of a prescribed burn is that the more country you've got that is recently burnt, the safer we are because there's less fuel load. That's totally different to a cultural burn, which has got nothing to do with reducing fuel loads. Cultural burns predate fuel load concept by many tens of thousands of years. So their purpose is essentially more like a gardening tool. So you are managing small areas very carefully and very precisely. You're choosing which plants you want to burn, which ones you don't want to burn. And so as a result, you're not trying to change a whole landscape. You're altering a very small area at a time and doing it in a very exact way. And what we see in the charcoal records, because every fire leaves a little layer of charcoal in the soil.
Mm.
Before colonisation, there was very little charcoal in the soil. And the moment colonisers enter an area, you get a huge surge in charcoal. And that's because colonisers started burning huge areas straight away. They were trying to clear forest to create grazing land. But before then, the cultural burns were focused on only burning very small, precise areas. So much, much less country was burned.
And recently you were a signatory on the open letter with GECCO, Gungurum Fire Environment Centre, calling yep. for the immediate pause in the planned burns in the Snowy River National Park, which sadly yep. on the 15th the burn started. Can you tell me more about why preventing these planned burns, specifically in areas like the forests in the Snowy River, is so important?
Yeah. So I've studied those areas for a long time. And one study that I published in 2018 looked at every fire that had ever been mapped for those areas. And what I did was ask, where are the bushfires happening? What age class of forest? Is it in young forests that have just been burnt, or old, long unburnt forests, as traditionally I thought? And what I found was that all of them are happening in the regrowth from previous fires. So that's the vast majority of bushfires happen. Not in the first couple of years after you've burnt. You have a few years break, but then you have a couple of decades where bushfires are very, very likely across those areas. So that's the problem with burning those huge burns around the Snowy River, is that you are trading a couple of years of low fire risk or a couple of decades of very high fire risk. And when you look across the fire history for those areas, what you see is that that landscape has just been burnt so frequently that it's been kept in that state of heightened flammability. There were no big bushfires there before the 70s, but since the prescribed burning programs began in the 70s, bushfires gradually started to come in, and now they're becoming a feature of that landscape when they never were in the past.
And what do you suggest for the future on stopping these areas from just continuing the cycle of being burned and then being more flammable? And is there any way that we can mitigate these fire impacts? Is it just leaving the forest to grow into old growth?
Yeah. I suppose just as the absolute baseline, if we did nothing else except not setting them on fire, we would be ahead of where we are now.
Mm.
So we're not getting an advantage from doing those prescribed burns at all. We're only getting disadvantage. And the reason is that even though they help in theory for the first couple of years, the fires we're getting through are too big for that to be any use. Nobody's going out there and trusting that, you know, a prescribed burn from 2 years ago will help stop a bushfire. So we've got no benefit. We've only got a cost from doing it. But even if you did nothing else, just to stop doing the damaging thing that's causing the problem is a start. But there is so much more we could do. And that revolves around tools that we know already work. Just rapid detection and suppression. They've fallen out of favour a bit in recent years, again through American influence, where, again, in American pine forests, they say that putting fires out too quickly has caused their fire problem. Now, I haven't studied that. I don't know how true that is in America, but these aren't pine forests. So we can't just take ideas from America and apply them to Australia. In our forest, what we need to do is find those fires as soon as they start and have a lot more remote area fire trained team. This is sort of firefighting I used to do, where they fly you out in a helicopter, and we used to winch down in Victoria. They rappel from the helicopter. You get down to that fire while there's often still just a single tree burning, and put that tree out.
Mm.
And you can prevent hundreds of thousands or millions of hectares from burning by putting that one tree out at the beginning. We know that it works, but the problem is we need a lot more fire crews who are available for that. We also need the small aircraft that can support them. We need CFA groups to have their trucks updated, need to have new trucks, have best gear on hand so that they can support with all of that sort of thing. But then there's also new technologies we can bring in. A lot of this is being developed through ANU. You can, one of the issues during, say, the 2003 fires was that as the storm front was coming through and lighting those fires, it was too turbulent to get crews out to put the new ignitions out. We had to wait until the entire front had passed, and by then, a lot of those fires had already grown too big to put out straight away because the weather was so bad. So there are situations where that happens. What is being developed at ANU is a system where you can have automated drones that are sent out as the storm front comes through. The instant there's a lightning strike, they the closest one flies to the strike, uses infrared to see if a fire has started. And at that same time, there's a plane like a Hercules flying above the storm that is carrying another type of drone called a water glider, which can carry 1,000 or more litres of water. That's dropped from the plane above the storm, flies down through the storm and is GPS guided right to the tree that's been hit. It drops the water on the tree and contains that fire. It may not put it out, but it can hold it until the front's passed, and then you can get crews to come out and do the work.
Yeah, wow. Is that,
yeah.
You said that was new research and stuff coming out at the moment?
Yeah, so they've got prototypes. Mm-hmm. Not 100% on where that works up to, but they've been working on this for some years, and I know they've got proof of concept, and it's the sort of thing I think could be rolled out in the next few years. So, and particularly if governments start investing in it, then there's the potential for that work to absolutely be a game changer. If we can get those fires put out while they're small, and if we stop lighting new fires all the time with prescribed burns. And the final thing is, we need to leave back burns as a last resort. The back burning, a lot of people confuse that with prescribed burning. Back burning is different. Back burning is when you have a bushfire going. In theory, you get just in front of the fire and you light a line of fire that burns back to it. But the way we tend to do it these days is that we keep crews well away from the fire, and they'll go to some of these new strategic fuel breaks that are being set up across the state, and they can light a fire from there, and it may be 10 kilometres ahead of the bushfire, and they'll burn out all of that forest in between. And what that does is it hugely expands the burnt area. You may, if you're lucky, contain the fire, but quite often those back burns also escape and make the situation even worse. So we need to leave back burning as an absolute last resort. Sometimes there's nothing else you can do, but the state has invested so much in those strategic fuel breaks, which won't make back burns less likely to escape. They will incentivize people to light them. And we need to get away from those incentives. We need people to actually go and do the hard work, putting the tree out before that fire spreads.
Yeah, stopping it before it becomes massive.
Yep.
Well, lastly, before I let you go, how can listeners find out more? Is there any way people can help maybe donate to the research or get involved with local CFAs, or any way people at home can help this?
Yeah, so I do, I've taken a short break from it, but I do try to put out more explanatory videos on Instagram. So that's one place where people can find out a little bit more. If you are an academic in some way or like reading scientific material, you can find me on Google Scholar quite easily. If anybody is wanting to donate, probably the best thing would be to talk to David Lindenmeyer at ANU, who I'm working with there, and he manages a lot of that sort of thing.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, it's been great, Hannah. Thank you.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR. We were just listening to a conversation that I had with Phil Zylstra, a fire behaviour scientist. To find his work, you can search Phil Zylstra, Zylstra, on Google Scholar, and his Instagram is at Winderong, Winderong.
TransFamily is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. TransFamily runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to TransFamily are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. TransFamily is a 3CR supporter.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, and also streaming live on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au, and if you're out and about, on the Community Radio Plus app. Over the weekend, many people across the continent gathered to commemorate the Anzac's involvement in World War I. Research published by the War Studies Group at the University of New South Wales, Canberra, last year shows that while 90% of people believe in the importance of Anzac Day, just over half of people on this continent actually engage in Anzac Day services. We are now going to play an excerpt from the People's History of Australia podcast, in which host Christian speaks with Robert Bollard, author of In the Shadow of Gallipoli, about how the Anzac myth is perpetuated and the state's attempts to paint the anti-war movement as unpatriotic as a means of justifying repression during that time.
That brings us to the end of the war, and I think for a lot of people listening, that kind of narrative of what happened during the war will be so completely at odds with what we're presented officially as to what was going on in Australia and with Australian troops during the period. And I think, like, in Australia, few events are as mythologized as the First World War. You know, that myth that we have of patriotism, national unity, everybody supporting the heroic Anzacs and all that sort of thing. I wonder if you could talk a bit about why you think this myth exists.
Well, I talk about a radicalization, but because it's quite clear from the Red Flag riots and various other things, that there was a polarization. And maybe you said, Billy Hughes may have lost the conscription referendum, but when he split from the Labor Party and joined the right, he won the election, in a thumping election in 1917. So it wasn't just a shift in society to the left, it was a polarization. And in fact, you had during the whole period of the interwar period, it's quite famously, there's a growth of proto-fascist secret armies, hundreds of thousands of members at their height, particularly strong in rural areas and in the middle-class suburbs of the cities. And this was under the surface, or barely under the surface, but what was very much on the surface was the cult of Anzac being promoted, most obviously during the war itself, but then afterwards as an attempt, direct attempt to undermine the radicalisation, to create an alternative, to try and rally people to oppose people who are unpatriotic and so on. And the RSL was essentially involved in this. By the way, it's little known. I mean, one just assumes that all the returned soldiers were in the RSL. First World War, they weren't. In fact, in 1924, I think it was something like 3% of those eligible to be members of the RSL. Only 3% of returned soldiers joined. Most working class soldiers just saw it as an organisation for brass hats, you know, for the officers, which it pretty much was. But the actual use of, particularly in schools at the time, and then more recently, of course, this has been a very profound thing as well, ever since, that this central myth of Australian nationalism has been incredibly useful to Australian government, because it's something that they can use to try and unify Australia, but unify it around a myth that, precisely because it is a myth, cannot be challenged. Because if you do attempt to challenge it, then you immediately... I mean, I remember being... One of the radio interviews I did after my book was with a very nice and very sympathetic, I thought, man from ABC Radio in Adelaide. And he was anti-conscription. He was a baby boomer who could remember the Vietnam War and so on. But he didn't like the fact that I criticised Anzac Day. He said, why are you criticising Anzac Day? So even someone like this, a smaller liberal, very much your cookie cutter, smaller liberal ABC presenter, was horrified by anyone would ever say anything critical of Anzac Day. It shows you how hegemonic that myth is, and that's why it's so useful to our rulers.
Yeah, totally. And I think there's a great passage at the end of your book where you say that in a period that we live in now, with declining union membership, declining wages, increased precarity in employment, privatisation, and the general worsening of conditions for working class Australians, Anzac, or the myth of it, kind of gives you something to cling on to and feel a bit better about yourself.
Yeah, it looks back to a period where it seems like people who sounded like us, looked like us, did great things. And that makes you feel better. And you need to feel better now, much more. I mean, I can remember, I'm old enough to remember, like in the 1970s, where no one gave a stuff about Anzac Day. And we didn't need to. It was just because people felt better about themselves. They didn't need to cling to this mythology so much. I also point out, I mean, in the introduction of the book, it's something that which has occurred to me, that I've had to teach the First World War in general history courses at uni. And it's astonished me when I come to the First World War and I say, okay, in a tutorial, anyone here been to the dawn ceremony in Gallipoli? Usually one or two hands go up. Then later on I say, okay, let's talk about the First World War. What was that all about then? Silence. Absolute. You can hear a cricket in the classroom. Yeah. Eventually someone might say, didn't some bloke get shot? It's astonishing that people would, you know, young people would invest the time and the money to travel halfway across the planet to commemorate a war and never occur to ask themselves what the war was about. Because you're not supposed to ask that question. They were Anzacs. They had slouch hats. They're the good guys by definition. You see, the whole thing is that, yes, we do commemorate the First World War. There's a lot of remembrance, but there's very little remembering.
Totally. Yeah. And so finally, what do you think all of the struggles of this era mean to us today?
It shows us something which really should be, which is really obvious relevant to the situation we are in right at the moment. How a prosperous, seemingly prosperous working class paradise can be plunged by a global crisis in the space of months into what looks like an apocalypse. And what happens when that happens? What can happen? What should happen? The positives, the negatives, and what we as individuals need to think about doing.
And that was an excerpt from the People's History of Australia podcast. I believe it's their fifth episode, titled The Hidden History of Australia in World War One, in which the host Christian is speaking with author Robert Ballard, who wrote the book In the Shadow of Gallipoli about how the Anzac myth is perpetuated and the state's attempts to paint the anti-war movement as unpatriotic as a means of justifying repression. Yeah, highly recommend that podcast and all of the work that folks do at the People's History of Australia podcast. You can listen to more from them at peopleshistory.com.au. And before we move on and play a little song, I'd just like to read out a quote that the People's History of Australia folks posted on their Instagram over the weekend from Alec Campbell, who's the last surviving Gallipoli veteran, saying, quote, "For God's sakes, don't glorify Gallipoli. It was a terrible fiasco and a total failure, and best forgotten," end quote. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. Stay tuned.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Spinning a beat. CIS was built on choice and control. Dignity of risk enabled through supported decision making means we lead our lives with everyday risks, not through others' decisions for us.
Listen to the interview with Megan Spenlet-Smith on Wednesday, 29th of April at 6 p.m. on 3CR 8:55 a.m.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter.
The Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
The Footscray United Cricket Club is seeking financial sponsors and players to ensure it continues to provide valuable community support. The club participates in the Victorian Turf Cricket Association and has been successfully engaging local youth for over 93 years. Until recently, the club proudly fielded junior teams, something it is keen to reintroduce. For details about the range of innovative promotional options available, please contact the President Con on 0417 347 134. The Footscray United Cricket Club is a 3CR supporter.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show at 3CR Community Radio. That song that we played before those announcements was Ring of Past by Men I Trust. That's the name of the band. We are now joined by Bo Spearham, host of the incredibly important podcast Frontier War Stories. Bo will be speaking with us about the Frontier Wars, which are also commemorated on April 25th. Over the weekend. Good morning, Bo.
Good morning. How are you going?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us. Maybe you'd like to start by telling us what April 25th means to you.
Definitely. But first, I'll just do like a more detailed introduction. So Yama, Bo Spearham, Gwamori Kuma, Marawari, podcaster, activist and dad, host and creator of Frontier War Stories, a podcast dedicated to truth-telling about a side of Australian history that has been left out of the history books. I've got about 30, 39, 38 episodes of the podcast
Been doing it for about 6 years now. And, yeah, I started on Anzac Day back in 2020. Yeah, and just to go into answering your question, what does Anzac Day mean, I guess? Very important question. I guess growing up, I never really noticed it or took much into it. But I guess growing up, understanding, politics and understanding history and understanding culture and patriotism made me sort of feel the same way that I feel in the lead up and on the 26th of January on Invasion Day. And we're, as black fellas, we're told to think a certain way, told to talk a certain way, told to feel a certain way. There definitely is a narrative that is already set. But, you know, thanks to, you know, elders and many Aboriginal people and allies around the country who have really stood by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who want to, I don't know if it's necessarily changed the narrative of what's being held and what's being said on that day, but definitely acknowledge more of the impact of First Nations / Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander communities and individuals who participated in the First War, or I should say the First Wars, that this continent took place in. And that goes back as early as, you know, or if you want to talk about conflict, it goes back as early as 1770 when the Endeavour sailed up the East Coast, went to Botany Bay, went to get out, had somewhat of a skirmish with local Aboriginal people, shot and killed Aboriginal people on the beach, and stole some spears and boomerangs. You know, the earliest conflict on this continent happened, you know, in 1770 when the Endeavour was flying past. And then obviously that conflict changed as the arrival of the First Fleet 8 years later in 1788. A whole bunch of ships rocked up with a lot of people, with the intention, to create a colony here on the East Coast. And this conversation, to have that and to create this new colony, didn't involve Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and it created conflicts with the local tribes along the East Coast who were first impacted. And as a result of that, we see countless wars, brutal wars, you know, sparked throughout the East Coast of Australia. Sort of spreading like wildfire. It moved fast and it was very brutal. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, do you think the push to sort of change the narrative surrounding Anzac Day by elders, do you think that that's sort of how the commemorations for the Frontier Wars came to be on April 25th?
Not even just Frontier Wars, but sort of adding and commemorating the sacrifice of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander diggers. In that sense as well, Aboriginal people have fought in almost all wars that, you know, Australia or the British thing. As early as the Boer War, you know, Aboriginal trackers were light horsemen, and this should be a known story. They participated in the Boer War in South Africa. Upon their return, everybody, even the horses, bar the Aboriginal men, were allowed back on to travel back to Australia. Were forced to live and were abandoned in Australia. In South Africa, and that was as a result of, you know, Aboriginal men not being citizens of this country, and as a result of things like the White Australia policy, which, you know, mandated that this country was supposed to be a country for white men, and was to make that access back into this country, or just into this country, a much easier process than of those of colour from other parts of the world. But yeah, it begs a different to sort of include that of Aboriginal people for so long. Aboriginal diggers, you know, wanted to march alongside and participate in Anzac ceremonies for so long. Aboriginal people and servicemen and women were denied even access to having a beer with their, you know, their digger mates at pubs.
Mm.
Well, hence, you know, because of the colour of their skin and how they identify. I'm only seeing recent in history the added of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander diggers and stuff as well. But yeah, now we're talking about, we're bringing a whole other conversation to the War Memorial, and this conversation that we're talking about is one of war, but then also it's one of acknowledgement, where, you know, this government and the British government has to have a clear look at themselves and have that conversation of, well, do we acknowledge that these were wars that were fought across, you know, so-called Australia, and how do we, you know, honour those as well? And if so, then, you know, they must, yeah, you know, rewrite how we look at history. Because it's still like a scene as, oh, well, maybe it didn't happen. You know, we still have conservative historians and, you know, conservative people in general that deny the atrocities that happen to Aboriginal people, which is quite sad. You know, and then, you know, like we see over the last couple of years what has happened when Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people would jump up and do something as minuscule, even though it's as important to us as blackfellas, as an acknowledgement or a welcome to country. You know, we're seeing this whole revival of this hatred for Aboriginal people. Yeah, and we've got to ask ourselves, what do we do, you know, to deserve such hatred and such, you know, you know, like what, over his, you know, past two centuries. Nothing much has changed in regards to how they see us.
Yeah, and of course it benefits imperial interests that this behaviour continues, right? I mean, we before I interviewed Bo, we had a segment about how sort of the myth of the Anzacs is perpetuated in order for the Australian government to justify repression against both, mm-hmm. You know, working class people and also Indigenous people across this continent.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very good that you mentioned even the pushback against, like, a welcome to country, something so minuscule. And it's, you know, absolutely disgusting that this behavior and the denial of what is currently happening on this continent continues. I wanted to ask, how do you find researching information about the frontier was, you know, particularly with all of the language that the Commonwealth uses to justify occupation and genocide.
Yeah, totally. I think for that side of things, I've got to go back and, you know, I've always loved history, as me, and even as a young fella in school and stuff, and in high school, and I remember it was like grade 11, like you could pick like specific elective classes, and I remember I picked history because, you know, I just loved history and stuff, but I picked it and it was the first lesson, and I went there and I had no peers, I had no, you know, friends, you know, in that class. I got very ashamed and shy, and so after that class, I switched to another class that all my mates were in. But you know, I always still loved history, and I always liked looking into history and then specific things, especially the history of this country. And I always had that, you know, desire and question to ask why things are so different between us and white fellows, on a social level, on a political level, on an economic level as well. And did we deserve all this? Did we do this to ourselves, kind of thing? And then finishing sort of high school, I always, would love to sit down with elders and have certain conversations and, you know, about history, about politics. And my interest for the real history of this country grew more and more, having those conversations and being given these sort of gems of sort of colonial history in regards to how we fought and how we survived and who these individuals were and that as well. And so it always grew and it was always there, this keen interest in researching. But also, I guess I had like an orthodox way of looking at history because, I struggled with reading, through the majority of sort of my upbringing and as well. And so like a lot of people that don't know, that struggle with reading, you'd pick up the books first, look at the pictures, and then sort of, trace through the words to understand what is going on and what is happening, and or look at sort of more video and audio kind of things to pick up and understand, and force yourself and push yourself through reading as well. And that's what, I would do and stuff as well. And because I've got a keen eye for history and I've got ADHD, you retain the good things and you hyper focus on the things that, you're passionate about. So I would just always hold these things in my head when either they were either told to me or I picked up in a book or I saw it on a documentary or something, and always retain this sort of knowledge and this keen history for the frontier wars. And it wasn't until like 2020 when I actually recorded the first episode of Frontier War Stories. And by that time, a good friend of mine, who's the first episode of the podcast, Callum Clayton Dixon, they've written a book about these people that are from Armidale, the Hunterman people, and the people around the New England area, about their frontier wars. And around that time, I've already heard enough about and done enough research around Dunderley and Multuggera and Pemaway and Yagan and Gendamara and Waliyar and, various different sort of Aboriginal frontier wars and heroes and figures to sort of push my interest in that field to want to capture more and understand more of that history. And I never thought doing the podcast that would be as big as it has gotten in regards to downloads. It's got over 200,000 downloads, I believe.
and a lot of schools and universities use it as a resource kit, you know, when talking about First Nations history, especially that frontier wars history as well. To go back to answering the question in regards to how do I search and research for some of these, the interviews and the people. Thankfully enough, like the history, the progressive history kind of community is very small, so a lot of those folks know each other. I remember the first 2-3 episodes that I'd done because I knew people in the community who wrote books, who were museum curators, who set up a bunch of Frontier Wars curations, as well as artists who painted Frontier War figures and wrote extensive stuff on these individuals. And then I stumbled across some historians who have written essays, books, and articles on frontier conflict. And that was Ray Kirkhove from Queensland. Wrote a lot of stuff, acknowledging that true history. And from the perspective, not just of the perspective of just writing about this history as from a defeatist kind of point of view. One of his books was called, spoke about the resistance and the tactics and the weaponry and then how Aboriginal people fought. Like, if you are listening and you are looking at sort of, looking at wanting to purchase books on this topic, definitely that book, How They Fought, by Ray Kirkhove, and also Stephen Gapp's new book as well, which looks at sort of a period of resistance, a coordinated resistance from the east coast of Australia. And so, like, look, this is the history community, I guess the progressive history community. It was very tight-knit and small, and so, like, I got onto one, and then they gave me the contacts for others. But then also publishers and that would also get in contact with me as well and call me and ask me to interview a new book that they were publishing that fit the context of the podcast.
Yeah. Bo, unfortunately, we have another interview lined up, so I'm going to have to let you go. Yeah, but thank you so much for joining us on the show. And yeah, we'd absolutely love to have you back.
Point. All good.
And we'll put a link to your podcast in the show notes for the podcast that we upload for the show. But thank you again for joining us.
No, all good. No, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Bo. That was Bo Spearham, host of the incredibly important podcast Frontier War Stories. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. We'll be back in just a second.
Play-based, culturally safe early learning is available in Victoria and sets our kids up for life. That's why Koori Kids can access 15 hours of funded 3-year-old kindergarten a week. And to give our kids even more opportunities to socialise and learn through play, from 2026, 4-year-old kindergarten hours will increase up to 25 hours a week. Together, we can give our Koori Kids the best start. Search Koori Kids Shine to learn more. Authorised by the Victorian Government, Melbourne.
A 3CR supporter.
Want stories straight from community, culture, language, music and more, all in one place?
Meet ICTV Play, the free on-demand streaming service from Indigenous Community Television.
Watch news, cooking, music, language programs, cultural shows and heaps more videos made by Mob for Mob, anytime, anywhere.
On your phone, your tablet or your computer, ICTV Play brings our stories to life and keeps us connected, no matter where we are.
Download the app today from your favourite app store or jump online at ictv.com.au/app.
Showing our way.
A 3CR supporter.
Friday, May 1st, is May Day, International Workers' Day. Join 3CR all day in our 50th year of coverage
in solidarity with the continued struggle for labour rights and fair working conditions for all our communities around the world.
We got May Day specials from regular Friday shows and special presentations from 3CR's programmers from across the grid. For more info, head to www.3cr.org.au/May Day 2026.
Friday, May the 1st.
Tune in all day right here on 3CR.
You're listening to 3CR on the Monday Breakfast Show here at 8:55 a.m. It was Lesbian Visibility Day yesterday and Lesbian Visibility Week last week. And we are joined on the show by Libby, who was a programmer here at 3CR with their show Dykes on Mics in the 90s. Is that right, Libby?
Yeah, do you know, I was struggling to remember what year we started, but I think it was 1996 that we started, and I was on the show for about 9 years, so I finished up in 2005, and other people continued the show after I left.
How long did the show go for?
With that name, I think maybe 10 or 11 years.
And how did you guys get started with it?
Look, 1996 was an interesting time in Melbourne. Mm. There weren't many dyke or lesbian-specific programs. I think Joy FM had just started programming, and they didn't have many dyke-only programs. So I think that was one of the reasons why we set up the program. And the name is not original. There's a Dykes on Mics that broadcast out of 4ZZZ. They've been going for 33 years.
Wow.
There was a women's coordinator at 3CR at the time, Anna LaParfa, who suggested that we call the program that. And I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. We'll
That's
go
a
with
great
that.
Name.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask, like, how was it being out and proud as a lesbian in the 90s compared to what it's like now?
What an interesting question. I think, look, one observation I'd make is people don't tend to use the term dyke very much anymore, so that's something that I miss.
I found there's a resurgence in the word dyke, actually.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. I was chatting to an old friend of mine the other day, and he used the term puffs and dykes, and I was like, oh, I haven't heard that in a while. And I felt quite fondly toward that term. Look, I think it was – I was ensconced in a bubble of rock and roll high school, lots of music, lots of women bands making music together, and there was a lot of feminist activism around that time. Lots of activism that was inclusive of trans women. I feel like that's really important to talk about, that even back in the day we were fighting for the rights of trans women to be part of community.
Yeah.
So I was a part of that activist group that really wanted to be inclusive and expansive around who gets to call themselves a lesbian or a dyke. So I think, there was discrimination, and in fact, there was more discrimination back in those days. We didn't have an Equal Opportunity Act in 1996 to protect us when we were out in the world, you know, wanting to access goods and services, et cetera. That came later.
Mm.
We didn't have, you know, for those people who want to do that, we weren't able to get married. So there was a lot of institutional and enshrined discrimination, and I would say there was a lot of interpersonal sexism, misogyny, outright kind of hatred, I would say, of lesbians, dykes, bi women, etc. I mean, the whole community. We didn't use the term LGBTIQ+. Then that was mostly gay and lesbian, and that in itself excluded parts of the community. So I think one of the changes that I'm really pleased to see now is more inclusivity, that we're more expansive around who can be part of community. I think that's a really good, that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, since LAG, Lesbian Action Group, appealed to exclude trans women from their lesbian spaces, made it to high courts recently.
Mm.
I was going to ask if you think that there's been a rise in transphobia within lesbian spaces since then, especially with, you know, people like J.K. Rowling in the UK and politicians around the world talking about being transphobic, you know, what do you think?
Yes, I do. There has been, absolutely. Unfortunately, Australian politics has followed down the path of the UK and the United States.
Yeah.
They're very influential, always have been, in our politics here in Australia. I think that transphobia and queerphobia, homophobia, biphobia, etc., goes hand in hand with the rise of fascism.
Yeah.
And, you know, supremacy ideas. And it's really easy to use a minority of people to further a broad political agenda, and I think that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. I feel really disappointed and sad that LAG has gone down this path. Yeah. I think they've fallen in with an ideology that is wrong,
mm-hmm.
and they're on the wrong side of history with this campaign that they're trying to prosecute. And from what I understand of that ruling, it's not over yet. They've just been allowed to appeal a decision. It's like a decision hasn't been made yet. So I think that, I mean, I'm not appealing for them. I don't believe I would have any influence over their decision, but I think when I see a lot of the comments that happen on social media from other parts of the community, and I see people who are organising parties and events, you know, proudly stating that they're creating spaces that are inclusive of trans people.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes trans men and trans women and non-binary people. They're the people that I want to support and cheer on.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the parties you want to go to anyway.
Exactly.
Well, do you want to finish off on maybe speaking on the importance on making sure that lesbian spaces remain trans-inclusive and maybe give some words of hope for queers during this time of, you know, the rise of fascism and, you know, stuff
look,
like
I
that.
Think it's really important that we know our history.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of great writing out there. If you're not sure, if you've got questions, seek out history. I think the writings of Julie Serrano, who really coined the concept of trans misogyny, is a really important place to start. Mm. You know, reading the voices of trans people and understanding things from their perspective is really important. We have to remember our history that, you know, 50, 60 years ago it was homosexual men and lesbians who are being excluded from spaces. We've had a feminism that has sought to exclude lesbians from feminist spaces. So the trans exclusion that's happening, which is very much linked to the rise of fascism, is a part of a very long bow of, you know, capitalist, patriarchal society trying to tell us dictate to us who we are and how we can be. And, of course, there will always be resistance to that. And I want to say thank you to 3CR, because 3CR has always been at the forefront of that resistance since it started in 1976. Mm-hmm. It's always had voices, queer voices on the air. And, you know, 50 years of 3CR this year, what an extraordinary achievement.
Yes, so exciting for the 50th party. Thank you so much for coming onto the show today. That's all we have time for, but, yeah, thank you.
No worries, Hannah. Have a good day.
You too. And that was Libby Jamison, who was a programmer here at 3CR. And that's all the time we have on the show today. But stay tuned for Women on the Line.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.